cookie blues. Chocolate on my finger, ice and on my lips, sugar diabetes pounds on my hips. I keep the nightlight burning in the kitchen, mama, so I can go downstairs and cruise. When I get them Oreo cream sandwich, chocolate covered cream filled cookie, filled by Nabisco, ain't no rookie. Next best thing to Nookie
Blues. Does that sound familiar to anybody?
Love their
words. Yeah, boy, I'll tell you, that sounded familiar to me. It just makes me break a sweat, I'll tell you. This is a friend of mine, Michael Brown, actually. He's got a CD of Life on Life Terms. All he does is go around the country and do recovery music for conferences and stuff. And when I heard that song, I said, wow, that just sets the tone. That's what an addiction is like. I mean, it's that seedy sound. And that, it just really, really got to me. So, at any rate, I thought we would, with that, press on. Let's say, what are we talking about when we talk about this sort of behavior, that addictive behavior? First thing I would like to do is to talk a little bit about the materials I gave you. I want to make it clear.
Are there any more of those?
Sure, I've got tons of them. I don't want to imply in any way that this has anything to do with SA-approved literature, because it is not. This is only my strength, hope, and experience and things that have helped me. The diagrams on there we will be going through during the talk, and I'll be recreating them on the whiteboard here so we can go through them a piece at a time. And the little article in the back was one of the foundation articles about this whole paradigm that we're going to talk about, which were by Doug Talbot, who was the medical director of the treatment center where I went when I was in treatment back in 1986. So this is an older article, but it's kind of the groundwork for the neurochemical basis of the disease. So that this is just stuff that has helped me. It is my own strength, hope, and experience, and nothing else. First thing that is very important is that this work was done with alcoholism being the basis and the model for understanding this. Just as we use the Big Book as our basis of understanding how to recover, understanding addiction came about by using alcoholism as the underlying model for the disease. And so a lot of this research has been based on alcoholism and has now been broadened to incorporate a lot of other behavioral and chemical addictions. One of the things is that he makes a big point of in the article is that disease is a disease because it fits all the criteria for defining a disease. And on the last article, there is a discussion of that. It has all of the characteristics that says that an entity must be a disease. It's a primary condition and not a secondary symptom. There are physiological and anatomic changes. It has a recognizable set of signs and symptoms that allow us to diagnose it. That it has a predictable and progressive course. And there are etiologic agents and causes that we can relate to it. So that if you are in the business of medically examining the question of whether or not something is a disease, the disease of addiction fits all of the criteria that says this is a disease, and it's not a disgrace. So just objectively, empirically, it fits the definition. And one of the things that is important for that is that it has a set of signs and symptoms that allow us to say that we can diagnose this disease. One of the, and I just listed those on the front of the handouts, one of the primary symptom and one of the things we'll talk about most today is the symptom of compulsivity. Compulsivity is simply stating the repeated use of a substance or behavior despite adverse and potentially lethal consequences to our lives. And if we're doing something despite the fact that we know it's harmful and are experiencing the harm from it, then we are suffering from compulsivity, which is the primary symptom of the disease of addiction. There are many other symptoms, as I said here. You have a destruction of physical health, of emotional health, of social, spiritual, and cultural life. There are abnormal changes in tolerance, and anybody that's ever been an addict will know that the first time you used, you got a hit off something small, and it got more complex, and it got more and more difficult to achieve the same hit without taking more and more of the substance or behavior. There's a sense of withdrawal or detox period, and there are blackouts or true drug amnesia. I don't know how many of you all have had that, but I've had certainly behavioral blackouts where I have lost time just in the midst of ritualistic stuff. And it doesn't necessarily, for me, have to be chemical, but the original drug amnesia or blackout description was for alcohol. I think it does translate to some of the behavioral addictions. So that there is a real clear-cut set of criteria that define this. So let's describe it and see how we developed learning that it was indeed a disease. Let's describe some of the characteristics as they went through learning about this disease. One of the things, and I haven't tried this, but I hope it works. If you have a person who has an addiction, it usually is a journey. It starts out when we use, then we will, after a period of time, abuse, and subsequently we will become addicted. Now let's use something that is fairly standard, like alcohol, to describe this. A user of alcohol is somebody that has a glass of wine and doesn't have any intoxicating effects from it. They may drink a user of alcohol may drink a half a glass of wine and leave it on the mantle and go on. And you know, that type of person is completely incomprehensible to me, but they do exist. But. Most of us are abusers. An abuser is anybody who has ever used alcohol to excess. Anybody who has ever been intoxicated by the use of alcohol has been an alcohol abuser. And that came very early in my life, by the time I was 12 or 13. But most of American society are abusers and not users. Then there is a certain, and people who take the journey of addictions become addicted. And then the person who is addicted loses the power of choice and just abuses over and over again despite the adverse consequences. And there will be a progressive decline in their mental, emotional, spiritual, and physical life, and it will progress on to death if it's unchecked. So most people who are even addicts will start out and use the first time and then progress to abuse and then become addicted. And me, this journey for alcohol took about, 45 minutes. not really. I did become totally intoxicated the first time I drank. It was in the midst of a sexual ritual, but I abused to the point of intoxication the very first time. So let's look at the American society. If you take seven Americans, and this research has been done for alcohol, and two Americans will only be users. As I said, most of us aren't users. Five of Americans will be abusers. Now, an abuser of alcohol is not an alcoholic necessarily. As a matter of fact, four out of five people that abuse alcohol will not be alcoholics. You know, they may drink a ton and get intoxicated and finally say, gee, this is getting to me, I need to cut down. And they'll cut down. Again, I don't understand that, but many people do. And there's a lot of abusers that drink far more than I ever drank as an alcoholic. But they can moderate that. And I think that's the same way with food. It's the same way with, there's a lot of people who are who tend to get into lust and then they leave it alone. It never has any adverse consequences on it, you know. But that's those are people that are abusers. However, there's this one out of that five, one out of seven, something happens. And that person goes on and they suffer some consequences. They say they need to stop, but then they go on and they suffer some more consequences. And then they go on and they suffer some more consequences. And then they start losing things. And they start getting advice that they need to stop this stuff. And they start knowing they need to stop this stuff. But then they go on and it gets more and more and more. And finally they go down and they die if they don't ever check this. If it's an unchecked progression, it can be and frequently is a fatal disease. So, for the purposes of this discussion, we are not talking about a user or an abuser of a substance because they do not qualify. It is only the person that continues to use despite all attempts, knowledge, advice, and adverse consequences that we're talking about. That is the person that fits the diagnosis of addiction. And that's the person that I am. That's what happened to me. And that was the person that I was interested in knowing about. So that's what this talk is about. This talk is about that seventh person. And you will hear people say, don't tell me about addiction. I knew Joe Blow who drank two quarts a day for 5 years and just quit. Great. I'm glad for Joe Blow, but he was an abuser and not an addict. Because anybody that can do that fails to meet the definition of what we're talking about. So it is not, I don't even discuss that. I mean, you know, so great, he did fine. Five times more people are abusers than they are addicts anyway. I am only talking about the person who couldn't stop. And so that's what this talk is all about. Now, the reason that people can't stop is due to the first and primary symptom of the disease, which is compulsivity. And compulsivity was that part of my behavior that completely baffled me. You know, why couldn't I discipline myself and use just enough willpower to take care of this one symptom? I could do it in every other part of my life. But this was driving me literally to death. So, what we're going to talk about now is the symptom of compulsivity. And again, we go back to the model of alcohol because some of the early research was done in alcoholism. Back, you know, I don't know exactly what year, but I think it was in the 50s, a lady did a study in Baltimore, and it was a medical study in which collected brains of alcoholics who had frozen to death on the street, and took them into the laboratory and did autopsies, ground them up, and extracted substances from the brains and things that medical researchers do, and then analyzed that. Extracted a substance that many of you may have heard of if you've studied the field of addiction called THIQ. And THIQ had some interesting properties in that it could be used to experiment on laboratory animals. Now, one laboratory animal that they used was the white rat. So if you took a white rat and you put it into a cage and gave it two bottles to drink, one of alcohol and one of water, you could leave it in there for as long as that rat lived and it would never touch the alcohol. It would only drink the water. However, if you took that same white rat and injected THIQ in it, it would go drink alcohol until it became unconscious. So they, for the first time, they said, gee, there's a biochemical factor that can transmit this symptom of compulsivity, and that it is not purely a behavioral and willpower issue. It has some biochemical basis. So, over the ensuing years, a lot of investigation has been done into the neurochemistry of what makes up compulsivity. And that's a lot about what Talbot has done. So that here is the model that Doug Talbot came up in, the paradigm, as I would say, that really has been helpful to me. And the reason and this is all down on that diagram. Somebody drew it out for me. I didn't draw that. Somebody drew that for me and printed it up. This is the best I can do. But I'm going to write it up here on the board because it just helps for me to develop it while I talk about it. One of the important things to remember in understanding this issue is that very broadly and very basically, we have two components to our brain, the human brain. We have this big glob, white glob, that sits up in our skulls that's called the cortex. And that's the biggest part of our brain. It's where we think, reason, and make choices. Okay? So that the person who decides to abuse alcohol or to use alcohol, the abuser makes a conscious decision to follow that behavior. That is a cortex function, a cortical function as we call it. Now, separate from the cortex is another part of our brain that's called the hypothalamus. Now, that's the old primitive brain that has been present for eons and eons in all species. It is also called, for the purposes of this behavior, of this discussion, the survival brain. The survival brain holds the survival functions of the organism. So it's very important to see that this is a separate part of the brain from the cortex, because we're going to spend a lot of time now talking about this part of the brain. And this explained a lot of things to me. So I'm going to blow this up, the hypothalamus, and say that we're going to talk about the survival functions that live there. The survival functions are the six F's. Food. We have to eat in order to live, and if you don't eat, you die and the species dies. Fluids. You have to know when you're thirsty, you have to consume enough fluids or you will die. Fight. You've got to know when you defend yourself. If a caveman was seeing the saber-toothed tiger, he had to be able to defend himself. Flight. Hopefully, if the saber-toothed tiger came at him, he knew when to run also. So, I mean, fight and flight are very important survival mechanisms. And if we don't have those things, then the organisms get annihilated and the whole species dies out. So it's a survival function. Feelings. We have to know the feelings that are accompanying these things in order to act. And the last one was reproduction, and we put flirt. Yeah. Have to be creative, you know. So that in order, if a species and organisms do not reproduce, then they will die out. So these are survival functions, and that's very important. It's important to know that these survival functions are more powerful than our ability to make decisions, because they can override our ability to make decisions. One thing that I have that I always talk about in this particular regard is that if you can visualize the stories of the sailors that are shipwrecked on the Pacific Ocean, and they're paddling around out there for days, they will ultimately get to the point where they're extremely thirsty and yet they have no water. Now, their cortex can tell them that if you drink that salt water, it's going to be fatal. But the survival function will say, you've got to have water or you're going to die. And there have been repeated episodes of this survival function taking over and actually overriding the cortical decision or the cortical knowledge that they don't need to be drinking salt water. So that we can look that even in healthy, normal circumstances, the hypothalamic survival brain can override the knowledge and decision of the cortex. So that's very important. Very important for the understanding of the symptom of compulsivity. Now, how does this work? I always thought when I was growing up that the brain was this giant transistors and you had sparks flying from one cell to the other and it carried messages and all sorts of complicated stuff. But actually, what it is it's a series of chemical reactions. And in this hypothalamic area, the chemical reactions that go on are the messages that we get about these survival functions are carried by things that we call neurotransmitters. And the neurotransmitters are many of them that we have. You've heard of the endorphins and enkephalins and serotonin. Anybody ever take Prozac? Serotonin is what Prozac affects. It helps mediate one of the neurotransmitters. And there's epinephrine, norepinephrine, dopamine. There's a lot of these things that exist there. And what that means is this, is that as this system works normally, if something happens and there is a need for drinking water, one becomes thirsty, there will be a deficiency and imbalance of one of these neurotransmitters. The one will go and take a drink of water. It will satisfy the thirst. The neurotransmitters will be rebalanced and the desire for water will go away. You know, you quench your thirst. And somebody who is a normal eater will have an imbalance when they get hungry. And they will go and they will eat a normal meal and will feel full and that will go away. Somebody who is not a normal eater like myself, that doesn't happen. But these are the ways that these survival functions monitor our behaviors so that we continue to live and keep ourselves surviving and balanced. Now, what happens is that there have been a number of studies done, at least in chemical dependency, that strongly suggest, and there are other studies that suggest, that there is a genetic tendency to develop addictions. And that there are lots of genetic trends in that. And I know in one field, like in the eating disorder field, I mean, there's something huge, like 80 or 85%. Well, it's 85% of the people with alcoholism have a positive family history. And something like 70, 75% of people with eating disorders have a family history of alcoholism or drug addiction. So that addiction seems to be genetically related, and there have been many, many studies that have supported that. So that the model that I have developed and the way that I draw that, now this is my diagram. This whole thing is something that came in my head, but the information is not mine. Is that I say that there's a genetic engineering difference in the hypothalamus that I'll say A for addiction. And if somebody has an A for an addiction and they're supposed to be an alcoholic according to their genetics, and for whatever reason they don't ever use alcohol, they'll never know it. Won't bother them. It's only use and abuse of the substance or behavior that waters the and fertilizes the little seed that sits in the hypothalamus. So that this journey of addiction that we talked about, this journey starts here, and then after a period of time in which we abuse the substance and behavior, the way I diagram it is that this little seed grows into a giant of its own. And that's when we've crossed this wall, we've crossed this biogenetic wall to have gone from use and abuse to where we are no longer have the power of choice. And what this basically means is this, is that this little seed of a genetic difference in the hypothalamus has been nurtured until it has taken on the power of an individual survival function like the other ones. And it has a set of neurotransmitters that it responds to also, like that. So that we get the sensation of the age-old saying, as I'm dying for a drink. If I'm dying for a drink of alcohol, that's really true. Is because in the hypothalamus, when one gets an imbalance of endorphins and cephalins or whatever the neurotransmitter is, the message comes out over millions of years that unless I rebalance that neurotransmitter, I'm going to die and the species is going to die. And as they say, I have to do this. And that's despite the fact that the cortex may full well know, well, the doctors told me that if I do this again, I'm going to die. But that doesn't matter. It's like the shipwrecked sailor. I have no choice. This information overrides everything else. Yes? No, we'll have questions and answers after this. So if you have questions, jot them down and we'll have a whole session and I'll stay as long as anybody wants to after the meeting and we can have discussion about this. So that we see that this is something that is separate from and out of the control of something of our ability to make decisions. So what we have then is a model or a paradigm that shows why we are powerless, why we're biogenetically powerless. Now, it also explains a lot of other things. I don't know how many of you have been through treatment, have been in therapy, and they start talking about, well, deal with your feelings. Or if you've seen the AA literature, it says, don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. Well, why did they know that? Well, 50 years ago, they didn't have the slightest idea what they were saying. But, I mean, you know, here you go. Get hungry, angry, and you imbalance these neurotransmitters. So if you get a hunger imbalance of your neurotransmitter and you're an addict or an alcoholic or something else, then it might be that your hypothalamus reads that imbalance as, well, I need to drink. I need to use. I need to act out. So that by getting yourself hungry, angry, lonely, and tired, one is making themselves vulnerable to the compulsivity that lives here in this hypothalamus. They observed that empirically over 50 years ago, and now we see that it does have some biogenetic basis to it. It also said if you've been in treatment, they say deal with your feelings. Well, the same thing. If you walk around with your feelings out of joint all the time, these are generating neurochemical imbalances, which could lead to the compulsion to act out. Is that here I am, the only way to rebalance this neurotransmitter is to act on my addiction. And so that it's very important to keep these things balanced. It's important to do the things in recovery that don't predispose us to be vulnerable to this system. Now, why does recovery work? I think that what we see is that there are many ways to rebalance the endorphins and enkephalins and the other neurotransmitters that other than sexually acting out or other than eating or drinking or whatever it is we're doing. And those things can be as simple as being with each other and sharing or being together in groups or giving each other hugs or simple stuff like that has been shown to be stabilizing to this neurotransmitter system. So that until we are able to become totally detoxified, those real close interactions are important. Now that brings up the final point just about of this particular aspect of the talk, is that we have, how long does it take to get from a little A to a big A? It may be a very short period of time, you know, for drugs such as cocaine, it is a very short period of time. For alcohol, it may take 15 to 18 years to cross over into this, and people may abuse successfully for a long time. And I would imagine that for the various forms of behavioral addictions of food and sexual acting out, it will vary from person to person and style of acting out to style of acting out. The important thing to know is how long does it take the little A to go back to a big A? I mean, to a small a. The big A to go back to a small a. Well, we don't know all that for everything, but for chemical dependency, the work that Talbot quoted to me years ago said that it takes 30 days to get the chemicals out of your system. It takes 6 or 7 months to get all of the particles and things out. But what it does is it really takes 11 and a half months to get a total return to where all of the neurotransmitters and neuropsychological testings return to normal. So that total detox, at least in the field of chemical dependency, takes 11 and a half months. Which is very interesting and fascinating, since that the early AAers figured out that there was something special about the first year. Is that after people had been sober for a year, they gave them a birthday. And I think that what we see now is that it does take that long to return the neurochemistry to its baseline. Now, once you get it back to a big A and you're a little A and you're a drinker, does that mean you've got another 18 years to get back that you can drink again? No, it does not. And I think that that's the misconception that the dragons of denial want to tell us. It may take 18 years to get back to get into it, and it may take 11 and a half months to detox, but it might take 11 and a half seconds to get back to the full addiction. And in people who are in AA have heard all of the stories where you go down to the store for a loaf of bread and wind up 3 weeks later at the dog races on the other side of the country, you never knowing how you got there because you went in and decided to get a beer. And the same thing happens if we go down to the local whatever shop and decide that we're going to act out, we're off and running. We don't have any time to enjoy this again. So that once we get detoxed, we then have to stay in some sort of maintenance recovery to keep this part of the brain balanced so that it does not allow us to dive back into the full-fledged compulsivity. Now, this is the biogenetic parts of it, and I think that for me was a very valuable piece of the whole story. And it gave me a great start as to say, you know, the first thing I have to do is to stop this behavior. I have to quit doing this so that I can detox, and I have to take the actions of recovery so I can keep my hypothalamic chemistry balanced. I have to do what I have to do, or I'm a dead duck. So that understanding this shifted my paradigm entirely. I stopped trying to use my cortex to control what I couldn't control because it was beyond the control of my cortex. I started to have to take actions that I knew would keep me balanced, and those were the actions of recovery for me. Now, after a period of time, I developed lots of other things, and I was talking with another member this morning at breakfast, and I was talking, I says, you know, 2.5 years into recovery, I found myself up at 5 o'clock in the morning, hurrying up to so where I could read and meditate, and then get calm, so that I could hurry up and then get to work. And then I worked real hard all day, so I could hurry up and get to a meeting, so I could hurry up and get home and eat supper, so I could hurry up and call my sponsor. And then I would say, oh my gosh, I'm not going to have time to sleep, and so I had to sleep fast, so I could get up in the morning and do it again. And I finally was doing bizarre things. I'd get home and I'd say, well, I really don't have time in the morning to do all the things I have to do. So I'd start getting out my cereal bowls and I'd line them up and get all my stuff out. And I'd make my lunches and I'd hang out my clothes, and then I would kind of spring out of the bed, and I would, and that, something was wrong with that picture. I was not happy, joyous, and free. I was clean, you know. I was abstinent in my food addiction. I was sober in my for my drugs and alcohol. I was sexually sober, and yet I was totally nuts. So that I expanded this to know that this is a biogenetic disease, but it's also a holistic disease. Compulsivity is not the only symptom of this disease. It's an emotional, spiritual, cultural, developmental disease. And so I had to continue my journey. And so this is the second part. You know, as I say, Paul Harvey says it's the rest of the story. But it's just as far as I've gotten today. I may have a different rest of the story as time goes on. I'm involved in the process. But here's the way that I understand this. This information I don't have in the handout. I do have this diagram in the handout. This information basically came from a book written by Sharon and Joe Cruz called Understanding Codependency. That's where this information combined with Talbot's information is where this diagram comes from. Again, this is my own visual conceptualization of the issue. So what happened to me, and how did I get to the point where I was enslaved to my own craziness again? Well, let's say I started out here when I got over my, when I started getting sober from my addictions, which were, you know, drugs and food and lust and all sorts of dysfunctional behaviors. As I had said, that this was a journey that I had to cross over this biogenetic wall, which is where going from little A to big A is. And it started out when I abused these substances. So what I did was that I basically went to 12-step recovery and stopped using the behaviors. And I spent some time detoxing from that. But what happened was is that I found I got into other behaviors. The first one was food, and it took me 14 months to get sober from that. And then I got into work. And then there are other things that people get into, and spending, and mine was just plain old busyness, I call it. That meant I was just getting, I was going faster and faster and faster. But there are a multitude of behaviors that I was using, and it felt very much like I felt here when I was addicted. You know, I felt, again, entrapped. And I was not happy, joyous, and free, which was the way I wanted to be. Well, what I looked at, and finally the truth came for myself, is that I was abusing, and I started abusing all of the substances and behaviors that I started abusing because I was responding to a generic quantity that I call pain. And that pain was shame, fear, anger, all sorts of different feelings and pain. I was using these original medicators to use. What happened to medicate? What happened was is that I happened to have the biogenetics of addiction, so I became more insane with my medicators than I was with the pain to begin with, and I couldn't stop it. So then I got back here and I faced the original pain and I started using other behaviors. What would happen was is that I would medicate and then I would get relief from the pain, and then I would have a letdown. All right, so that the letdown would then require me to use the pain, use it again. So I would start going round and round and round and round. Now, Bill Wilson, after he'd been sober in AA for 20 years, discovered that he was doing this same thing. And many of you have read any of the writings of Bill Wilson. He wrote a letter to the Grapevine in the 1950s called the Emotional Sobriety Letter. It's in the language of the heart, if any of you have that, in which he described doing these things. And he called these things that he was doing his unhealthy dependencies, or his absolute dependencies, or his paralyzing dependencies. I think he describes it in several ways during this letter. So these were his dependencies. So this is not something that's new. It's been described since the 1950s by Bill Wilson. Over the years, we have developed this a little bit further in our current recovery setting, to where we now call them the coexisting dependencies, which is what coexisting is, what codependency is. Coexisting dependencies are codependency. Now, what is the danger of that? The danger is that if we get into this cycle over and over and over and over again, it will ultimately give us enough momentum that we're likely to go back into the old behaviors. So it's very important for people in recovery to get out of this cycle. And there are many people who are not addicts who are just codependent, and they feel a lot like an addict because they're trapped in this cycle and they just didn't happen to have the biogenetics. So what is this? What is the source of this pain? Well, my experience is the source of this pain is life's experiences. That's right. Most of my life experiences have been good, but I've had a lot of painful ones too. And so that when I was growing up, I quickly learned that if it was not good to have a painful life experiences, that I learned quickly to deny and repress these. So from very early in my life, I started denying and repressing things. And I would say I was okay when I wasn't okay. Frequently. Oh, I'm fine. I got it. Just fine. And then when I didn't feel like I could cope with not being fine, I'd medicate, you know. When you're 5 years old and 6 years old and have already learned how to masturbate and medicate with food, it's easy. You just retreat and binge, you know. So I became the A number one all-American child. You know, I was the star everything on the outside. And on the inside, I kept heaping up this pain. You know, I like to say that I was traveling two roads from very early in my life. I was traveling a yellow brick road, like Dorothy, and was showing everybody that, you know, I'm a star student, and I'm a great baseball player, and an athlete, and la-di-da-di-da-di-da. And in secret, I had this whole secret life of black rituals. You know, I call it the black road, the dark side. You know, like Star Wars, it was the dark side of the Force was leading me. And this dark road over the course of my lifetime developed into what I call an emotional abscess. Anybody ever had an abscess or a boil or anything? It hurts, you know? This is the pain that was driving me to do this, which ultimately drove me to the insanity of the cough syrup in the bathroom. It goes all the way back there. So, what's the solution? The solution is to get past all of this and to incise and drain this abscess like any good surgeon would do. So that we finally make this journey back through this to do what we want to do to begin with. And that is to live life. You know, life's experiences is what spirituality is all about, as I was talking. Living life, being alive. And it took me a lot of journeying to get back here. You know, I had to go through a lot of muck. Now, I didn't have to go through all of it before I experienced my first life. You know, when I first detoxed, I took a shuttle bus over here and lived for a while. And then I got back in here, and I got back into this a while. And then I stopped some of that, and I took another shuttle bus and lived life. But you know, I kind of periodically work my way through this. And the last is to be sure that I get rid of the denial and the depression. So repression, so I don't keep filling up this abscess. So this is the journey that I have to take. And this is very important to me as a physician, just as an aside, because this goes on in a lot of people's lives. And I have people who come to me with other diseases, such as diabetes, for instance. And people with diabetes, and I can't seem to do anything about their blood sugar, it's primarily because they're involved in some sort of compulsive acting out with food. And that there's this giant thing going on there, and there's not enough insulin in the world to medicate somebody that's doing this. This is a monster that you can't shoot it down with a BB gun. You've got to take this journey and start doing some of this. Likewise, let's say diabetes is a separate disease. There's another separate disease that many of us have. And that is depression. Depression is a separate disease process, clinical depression. Now, to be sure, part of the pain here can be depression. And it's very hard to sort out which is which. Now, I think that here's a very important thing that I have found in my life in recovery. Is that before I knew any of this, I worked real hard on getting rid of my depression because it was a primary disease process and I just had to have the right medication and the right psychotherapy and I was going to be okay. I didn't know that this was going on. So guess what? It didn't get better. It got some better because, you know, you could get some relief from the depression with antidepressants. But as long as this is going on, I mean, there's a giant under there that's making me feel bad before I know what's happened. So this is an important thing to tackle, and that depression doesn't go away with just antidepressants. Likewise, I think that there are many people who get into recovery and say that taking this journey is the answer to everything. It doesn't. It won't cure diabetes. I'm sorry. I mean, if you need insulin, you need insulin. And if you have a separate biochemical disease of depression, people may need to take that too. So that this journey just explains the emotional and spiritual and developmental journey that I need to take so that I won't have to keep experiencing the lifetime of pain that I've had. I think it's very interesting to look at this model, because to me it's very important to see the wisdom of the early 12-step people. What is this? You know, this is the journey of taking the steps. Most of the people did their original work and came and got here, and this is the work of steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. Cleaning up the emotional wreckage of the past. You know? That's what this is all about. Is that if we don't clean up the wreckage of the past, we're going to have this abscess that's going to drive us to do these behaviors and drive us back to the compulsive acting out again. So that it was my experience, though, that I needed some help to do my steps on a more experiential level. I'm a control freak that lives in my head most of the time. I did all my inventories, very calmly gave them away, wrote out all the things and said, yes, I've taken care of these steps and I'm ready to go on with my life. And I didn't do a thing to this. I mean, this turned out to be and still is a gut-wrenching experience of actually pouring out the emotional pus that lives inside of me. And it's a lifetime journey, you know. Recovery is something I don't graduate from, but I get better and better and I live life more and more enjoyably. Because I am taking this. But this helps me. It's a map. It's a paradigm. It shows me where I'm going, where I am, and what I have to do in order to get better. And it's very useful to me because I know I have my footing. I have my vision. And I'm not lost. I'm not bewildered. I'm not in despair anymore about what's happening to me. And it's a very, very pain-relieving experience to do that. Now, it all starts, as we said, by I have to give up control. You know? It all started when I surrendered the cortex's illusion that it can control this. And that as I make this journey, I get back to living life. It becomes a free-flowing experience. Life ceases to be a struggle. It ceases to be one crisis after another. It's kind of a free-flowing, really marvelous experience. You know, I like it's like riding a bicycle and you're gliding down the hill. It's for me, it's like shooting a basketball and seeing it go through the goal. It's a feeling of the flow of things. But I had to kind of muck my way through all of that before I ever got any chance to feel that. So. Surrender is the key to this thing, and perseverance and discipline to take the journey is also a key. And I really encourage people not to stay into perpetual heavy does it. Okay? Perpetual heavy does not get us anywhere, or it doesn't get me anywhere. Is that I take frequent vacations from up here, you know? I may be down here for a while and say, I got to go back up and live life for a while. That doesn't mean I have to use. That just means I have to live life. And living life is what this is all about. So, I think that I'm going to end it right here as far as the lecture part is concerned. And we will open it up. Anybody that wants to leave, take a break, do whatever, go ahead and leave, because I think that that's all. This is all we really, really have to do as far as covering the information. I'm going to stick around and we'll answer questions if y'all would like to stay here and to have some. And we will. I'll repeat the questions and then we'll answer them after that. So, yes.
My name's Gary, and I'm a sexaholic.
Gary.
Yeah, I think that's great. I learned a lot of new stuff. I'm also a physician, and I also share with you. I'm a food addict, a compulsive worker, and I live in my head. I'm very used to writing things in flowcharts and diagrams and trying to control things, and therefore master them by writing them down the way I've done my life. And I think it's really a good presentation that you've done, a wonderful presentation, a lot of good work in your recovery. The one thing that was missing for me in these paradigms was God. You hinted at it, at God, but you didn't put it down in your paradigm there. And my problem was that I knew a lot of this stuff and kept on acting out for years. And I knew that I was acting out, and I knew why I was acting out, and I knew about all the diagrams and flowcharts. But the one thing that I was missing was where God fits in. For me, my life experiences were painful because I was abused, and continued to be painful because I lived life without God. And I didn't learn that life experiences for me could be a mixture of pain and joy, and the joy is present only to the extent that I let God in my life. I have some doubts on some of the genetic stuff, but you know, I think it's a wonderful paradigm to get started on. And the title of this whole thing was, you know, Why I Need to Surrender. And you know, I think that that's a really good paradigm. But my paradigm now not only includes the disease concept and the codependency concept, but the fact that if I live my life without God for 1 minute, I'm in trouble. And I'd like to see and work on a paradigm that includes it all. You probably need a lot bigger truck board to do this.
I guess the question is, how does God fit into this paradigm, I guess is what it is. And for me, as I said last night, that was a struggle. And God is something that I don't understand. And so I have left it out with only references to the spiritual part of finding different ways to keep our compulsive behaviors in check, rebalancing our neurotransmitters or whatever it want to be. That infusion has to come from the spiritual realm, whatever that spiritual realm is. I agree with you. There's no way that I can make a flowchart that adequately describes what God or spirituality is. And maybe that's something that I need to consider. Maybe that needs to be the rest of the story. I certainly can relate to what you say. Yes.
Hi, I'm Doug. Powerless over lust.
Hey, Doug.
I'd like to check something out with you, Lee. Is actually sensed a miswiring almost. In other words, there'll be an urge to act out, to lust, and then I'll realize, no, I was actually hungry, or I was tired, and I've just recently become aware of that it's actually the wrong message is happening. I was needing something really basic, and instead I was filling it. I had learned somehow to fill it with lust. And then my second part of this is, what I've recognized also is that there actually seems to be an awareness of a physical change. Like, it's almost like some substance is shooting through my body when lust or acting out starts.
The question is, what are there actual biochemical changes that occur during lust, and can they get cross-wired with the impulses to eat or to satisfy something else? And I think that the answer to that question is that, in my belief and in my paradigm, it does indeed make sense to say that if you have some neurochemical changes that are precipitated by hunger and thirst or fatigue or anger, that the addict's brain can read that as a need to act out in order to restabilize that neurochemical balance. And that's what the origin of don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired is that there actually is a crossover into them allowing you to have the compulsion to act out. Yes?
My name is Jeff. I'm a psychologist.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
Last night you hinted at the fact that 4 years of psychoanalysis didn't work.
Right. Correct. Correct. 4 years of psychotherapy
and
didn't.
Sort of a follow-up on the first question that was asked.
Yeah.
In terms of, as I've seen your diagram, the difference between, I've had that same experience, psychoanalysis mm-hmm. not working, and looking at the psychological aspect sure. of the disease, you know, of my recovery process and whatever. And God has been the missing element for me, too.
Yeah.
How do you see this diagram up here, particularly, and maybe the previous one that you had up there, different from what you got in the 4 years? Like, because in my mind, and correct me if I'm wrong, I would think you have to see a difference between this and those 4 years to be believing in this.
Yes. Question is, how does this paradigm have a separate approach than psychotherapy as a solution? And the answer to that for me was that my approach to psychotherapy was to live in my cortical function, my cortex, and that I was getting information and searching out more discipline and more control without a emotional and spiritual infusion to rebalance that. I mean, I didn't have I was working in my cortex for control rather than to attack.
That's the surrender you're talking
about.
Surrender is give up the thinking process
and take
go do what's got to be done.
Take the actions.
This diagram.
Yeah, take the actions. Yes.
When I submitted to my name is Myron. I'm a sexaholic.
Hi, Myron.
When I submitted to medical authority to take a serotonin uptake inhibitor for depression, I found a tremendous, significant change in my compulsive drive to act out. Does that mean that I could take a pill to do some of this?
The question is, since the serotonin uptake inhibitors do regulate neurotransmitters, can this all have a medical solution sometime? And I think that there's been a lot of research and a lot of thought along those lines that we can have a magic bullet, so to say, that will take care of compulsions to eat and to act out sexually. And there are people who have greatly diminished sexual drive because of some of these drugs. However, my own particular belief is that a lifetime of living with this compulsion and a lifetime of abuse and pain will not be eradicated by the magic bullets. Is that they may be adjuncts to helping people. At some people may find them helpful in the future, but that's something that's coming up. You had a question.
Yeah, my name's Eric, and I'm a sexaholic.
Hi, Eric.
Along the same lines, I've been on the same thing, a serotonin inhibitor, uptake inhibitor, whatever, for about a year. And my experience has been that it has helped me somewhat to not pick up the drug. It's made it easier to not pick the drug up. But when I pick the drug up, the same powerful effect is there. I mean, you know, looking through the TV and suddenly seeing the sexual image has that same adrenaline rush. So that it has helped somewhat in helping me not to pick the drug up, but I'm definitely not cured of the power lust has over me.
And so we're having an experience here that says that there has been a diminished impulse to actually start the acting out, although it does not not eradicate it entirely. And I think that my own feeling about that, and dealing with lots of people who take serotonin uptake inhibitors, is that there's a wide variety of responses individually and how people respond to these things. And I think that, and like it says in A Vision for You in the big book, is that we realize we know only a little. We really know really only a little. And so we're going to learn more. Yes?
Hi, I'm Robin, a sexual codependent.
Hi, Robin.
And I really like to address the subject that was brought up before about the missing spirituality here in your flow chart. And you admittedly that that's
yeah.
a difficult area.
That's a difficult area for me, yes.
So you might want to add it up here into your circle as something that is definitely a need that we have for survival, you know. And when it becomes out of balance also, this is what affects us a lot.
Good point.
I think that we really focus too much on what we see and black and white issues, and that the spiritualness somehow brings up a fear.
Mm-hmm.
of the unknown, which it seems that mankind doesn't want. They want to know what it is. And the miracles that we experience come from that area that is missing on your chart.
I think that that's an excellent point. The point that was made is including in this paradigm under the which says survival brain is to put possibly on the opposite pole from the A, an S for spirituality, because you know, as I something that I haven't thought through in great detail, but having your suggestion here is an excellent suggestion, because as far back as we know about mankind, there have been spiritual needs and have been coming together, and I think that that is an excellent point. I really appreciate that. That's right. It's exactly right. Somebody back here. Yes.
Yeah, I'm Joe. I'm a psychologist.
Hi, Joe.
Question again on the psychological part. I wasn't here last night. So maybe you answer this. Do you see any importance to the 4 years of psychotherapy? I mean, what effect, if any, positive effect, if any, do you see that had for you? It sounded like you were saying it didn't do anything, or are you saying it did do something but not enough?
The answer is, what was the importance of, in my experience, of the psychotherapy that I did for 4 years? And I'm glad you brought that up, because in retrospect, I really believe that the psychotherapy saved my life in a lot of respects. What it did not do was to eradicate the disease, okay? And I think then what it did do is that it gave me the opportunity to examine myself. It gave me an ability to be honest about what I was doing, and to actually come out and talk about it and describe it, so that when I did start the recovery process, I had a 4-year jump start on honesty, inventory, and examination of my own self and my behaviors. I just had it in the wrong dimension, you know. And as you all are teaching me today, the spiritual dimension is still an important part that I am learning about, and I'm continuing to try to learn about. Yes, you had one back there. Hi, Alan.
Could you expand a little bit on the life experiences that you have up at the top of the chart?
All right. The question is, could I expand on the very general term of life's experiences up here? That's a very general term that incorporates a lot of things. One of the things that this incorporates is, I think it was Gary that said, that life is a combination of painful and joyous and happy experiences. That is normal. And part of this is the root of how I handled the painful experiences abnormally and developed an emotional abscess. It is also the destination that I am going back to, in which I want to experience my life as a combination of happy and sometimes painful experiences, with the spiritual healing to allow me to accept and to live that life. Yeah. Okay. Yes. No, right here. You're next.
My name's Bob, and I'm a recovering sex addict.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, Bob.
You mentioned that on this this paradigm here. Oh, I'm sorry, it was on the first one. Okay, we said that instead of using the cortex, we must take action instead.
Yes.
For someone who's used cortex or has tried to for many years, what can you just elaborate on that? Like, what do you mean by taking action without thinking? You know, is that what you're saying?
The answer is, the question is, what do I mean by taking action rather than using my cortex to try to control? What I visualize myself as doing is that for years I got sat down and tried to think out what I was doing, why I was doing it, and decide that I wasn't going to do it. In the recovery process, I stopped trying to make those decisions and surrendered to listen to what other people were telling me to do. I took directions to stop trying to figure it out and to go through the motions of don't use, go to meetings, get a sponsor, make phone calls, do service, accept hugs, give hugs, do the various things like it says, and then once you do that, the steps in the recovery program are the solution. Yes.
Yeah, I didn't get
hi, Bob.
The biogenetic wall.
Yes. The question is, what is the biogenetic wall? And on the first biogenetic paradigm there, there is a little arrow that goes from the little A inside the hypothalamus to a big A. And when one transforms from a time when they just have the seed of addiction to where it's a fully developed addiction, then one has crossed the wall and is in full-fledged compulsivity. And that's the way we were doing that. Yes, in the back.
This lady was born in the sex hall.
Hi, Vaughn.
I didn't hear the whole thing. She talked about the gremlin. I heard members talk about the different feelings of gremlin. I felt that myself. I don't know what a gremlin is. Mm-hmm. The most joyous state, even a spiritual high that can be.
The question is, what did we talk about adrenaline? I did, but I didn't write it down, didn't mention it. It is one of the neurotransmitters, epinephrine, that we feel. And I think part of the rush we feel is we describe as an adrenaline rush. But it is one of the neurotransmitters. It's also a hormone that goes all over our body and causes a lot of the heart racing, the tremors, and the excitement feeling. I think that it certainly does, in many people, play a role in that, because I remember that during some of my acting out rituals, I trembled and shook so badly that I could almost not follow through. It was such a highly charged time in my adrenaline outpouring. Yes, we have one.
Yeah, hi, my name is Michael. I'm a psychologist.
Hi, Michael.
I wanted to comment on where spirituality might fit in.
All right, I'm listening.
Going back to your original chart, the biogenetics of addiction, the cortex. The cortex is deluded in thinking that by thinking it can control the addiction cycle via reason. Now, our experience is unanimous. This is a spiritual problem. It is only in Western tradition we view the person as body, soul, and mind. Well, it's only the mind that thinks that the mind is that important.
Yeah.
And what this woman suggested, I believe, is absolutely brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
That an unbalance in one's spirituality can also set off a sort of thing. The mind's addiction is to believe that the mind can correct an imbalance in spirituality.
Right.
And that one literally needs to leave the Western mind-centered mode of thought into something that addresses a spiritual view of the person in order to correct a spiritual problem.
So what I hear you're saying is something more attuned to the meditation types of things that are done in possibly the Eastern religions. Yeah, and I, and that may be. That's the Western. Yeah, well, that's right. That's right. Gee whiz. I'm trying to figure somebody who hadn't had a chance to ask a question.
Okay, hi, I'm Peter. I'm a sexaholic.
Hi, Peter.
Sort of along the theme of where does God fit into this. You know, for me, I guess, you know, as you were drawing this, my reaction automatically is, oh, good, now I have a map. Now I don't need my higher power because it's all mapped out for me, and who needs him? And, you know, I guess for me, what I can see is, you know, where I need my higher power is, okay, what does this mean for me today? You know, I mean, one thing I really can relate to is that darn circle right in the very center of the drawing. And, you know, what does it mean for me today to take the actions that I need today? And there's no way I can have either the knowledge on my own or the power to do it without involvement of God on a daily basis. And I guess that's how I can see my experience maybe trying to apply God to this, you know, paradigm.
Yeah, I think that the comment is that God is really necessary to be kind of the energy for the actions and to drive it. I'm not sure that you need that on a daily basis to keep going. Brian.
Hi, I'm Brian, a sexaholic.
Hi, Brian.
Couple comments or questions. One thing you started to kind of get to, and I'm not sure if you were going there with it or not, but I had, along with getting involved with SA and coming to real acceptance of it, I was also having a lot of trouble all of a sudden with panic attacks and anxiety. And one of the things that I have taken out of my system is caffeine. To me, that, you know, that just puts you in a state of mind, and I know it's affected me with the addiction and with the panic that just put you in this heightened state, this nervousness state, which I'm generally a nervous person anyway. But just to have that cleansed out of your system, it seems to lower that scale. Do you find that to be...
The question is, does caffeine help improve the overall situation? And I have found that minimizing all mood-altering experiences helps, and some people respond differently to caffeine than others. And I think that has to be an individual thing. Yes.
Back at the beginning about the point of change of paradigm of the difference between change of attitude, I'll call it, between it's a disease and not a disgrace. I would consider that kind of a spiritual awakening. I was just wondering how long it took you to get to that point in recovery and if you slip in and out of it even today.
Question is, how long did it take to get to the point where I believe this is a disease and not a disgrace? And do I slip in and out of it? And the answer to the second part of it is yes. and that's the reason it helps me to do this for you all and for me, is that I need to hear it. And I need to re-emphasize it. It took me probably a fairly short period of time because I was given the opportunity to go to a treatment center where this was the actual central point of the beginning of this. You know, we talked about this as we're going to approach this as a disease, and this model was given to me within the first two weeks that I was in recovery, so that I had the exposure to this, and it felt better as I went along. But then I kind of come and go with that. Yeah, you have one other thing.
What I really meant to say is the difference between my cortex and my heart. When did you get it in your heart compared to your cortex?
Oh, that comes. That comes and goes. Comes and goes, and I think that I'm better than I was about 2.5 years into recovery when I really did some gut wrenching work, and started draining the emotional abscess. Some I got more and more in my heart then. Yes. Eric.
One thing I wanted to comment on the hunger situation, the God hunger. I had had God in my life from age 14 on. I was deeply religious. I was running Bible studies one night, picking up prostitutes the next night. So I had the God aspect in there. What I didn't understand, and I think that's where this helped me a lot, is I didn't understand what lust... I knew that I was acting out. I didn't know lust was a problem.
Yeah.
And when I heard Jess's tape about lust being the only issue, that's when it suddenly clicked. Mm-hmm. That's what I've been trying to stop. But I had no idea that in fact, had become my God, even though I thought I had a God.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it is. It's the opposite pole on this model that Robin proposed, it would be the opposite pole. The A would be the opposite pole of the spirituality. And that, I think that was, that's a very, very good suggestion, and I appreciate it. Listen, you all have taught me more than I'm sure I taught you all today, and I'm glad to be here. Let's clear the room so that the next group will have a chance to get here. I'll be glad to be around.